This is November 27th, 2010, and it's the day of our great Jukai ceremony later on this afternoon. So naturally, I'm going to address the matter of taking the precepts, starting with the repentance gatha. The repentance gatha is how we begin the precepts. As a way of sort of clearing the decks, hitting the reset button, shaking the Etch-a-Sketch, and getting a fresh start. You know, the truth is that with every breath, we're getting a fresh start, aren't we? We learn this in Zazen, that at any point, at any moment of our consciousness, of our waking hours, we have the opportunity to drop everything. And then maybe we find ourselves clinging to thoughts again in our Zazen, and then but there's another chance, and then another chance, and so forth. In the repentance, in taking repentance, we're not just dropping what we've done, painful things we've done and said and thought in our whole previous history. We are starting afresh and really kind of freeing ourselves from the binding effects of all that stuff of the past. And it does bind. We know this. We know it's part of this lifetime of conditioning where we, as a result of having done things and said things and thought things that that reduce our sense of who we are, as a result of that, it affects our faith in our own true nature. So this is one of the big reasons why we take the precepts, starting with the repentance, is so we can start over again and to some degree discard that self that we imagine is stuck somehow, is conditioned in some absolute way by the past. It is conditioned, and that's the nature of what we call the self, is it's conditioning, it's karma. But the other side of it is, that's just half the truth. Yes, we have an awful lot of psychological and other factors at work on us every waking moment and non-waking moment. But and the other side of it is that each moment, with each breath, we do have a chance to choose differently as to how we think and how we speak and how we act. This is the real value of taking the precepts, taking them seriously, not just mouthing them, but really taking them seriously, is that they have such a profound influence. Taking them has such a profound influence on our practice, or certainly it can. There are these three legs to practice that every Buddhist school honors. This isn't just Zen. It's Tibetan Buddhism and Vipassana Buddhism. The three legs of this three-legged stool of practice are meditation, wisdom, and morality. Or morality is basically comes down to the precepts. These three are so intimately, mutually conditioning. it is very difficult to set our practice in solidly in faith, and a faith in our own enlightened nature, if we're doing or saying or thinking things that are contrary to that enlightened nature. Instead of acting out of the nobility of our true nature, this would be acting out of what is ignoble in ourselves. And we can't, nothing is free. We can't get away with that and still preserve our faith mind in its fullest. Yeah, we can get away with it. We can get away with all kinds of little transgressions when no one is looking, when we don't get caught. But it has a negative effect on this mind of faith that is really the base of our practice. So, if we are, let's say, let's just pick a precept. I can see this deck of cards, 10 cards opening up. Let's pick a precept. Let's take number 3, misusing sexuality. If we're doing that, maybe even once, but certainly as a pattern, if we are exploiting other people, using or misusing other people sexually, then that is bound to stain the mind and affect our sitting and our whole practice. If we're lying, if we're allowing ourselves to lie to people in something other than just a very light kind of social lie where we are less than brutally honest about the sweater someone's wearing, allowing ourselves to lie to people, then that can't but have leave a stain on the mind, and that affects our practice, not just our sitting. Yes, our sitting. If we're doing these things and we cross our legs and try to concentrate on the practice we're working on, these things can creep in and really derail our concentration because of feelings of guilt or just something unfinished that's hanging in the mind. But that's just the smallest part of our practice, in a way, is the sitting. It becomes when we violate these precepts, then it feeds into our self-image, our sense of self-esteem, and this has a far-reaching, pervasive effect on our practice as a whole, not just the sitting. The Chinese Zen master Linchi, or Rinzai, famously said, "A moment of doubt in your heart is Mara." Mara is sort of in the popular Buddhist mind, it's sort of the Buddhist Satan, or the devil. He also said, "What ails you? Lack of faith in yourself is what ails you." Lack of faith in yourself is what. How can we have faith in ourselves when we're doing things that causes pain to others and to ourselves, or saying things that cause pain to others and to ourselves? So upholding the precepts is a way of moving through the world without causing unnecessary pain. Who wouldn't want that? Because we discover sooner or later that causing unnecessary pain to others is a way of causing unnecessary pain to ourselves. And it's not a matter of pitting our good self versus our bad self. This is a very common mistaken notion, probably deeply ingrained in our Judeo-Christian culture. The good against the bad, the good person and the bad person that we are. We don't have two natures. We really don't. Our nature is enlightenment. So when we simply see ourselves holy, then we will want to refrain from killing and stealing and misusing sexuality and lying and abusing drugs and alcohol. And to see ourselves holy, not compartmentalized, we need to still the mind. We need to let thoughts settle. So this is the very crucial connection between upholding the precepts and keeping the mind, or not cleaning the thoughts, in whether it's sitting or at other times. And we are more likely to realize this true nature to the degree that we can base our practice on the sitting and the precepts. So we begin the ceremony with repentance, and in that we're sort of exhaling. That's kind of what the repentance ceremony is. We're just, okay, all that stuff that I've done and said and thought, okay, let's let that go. And not just the letting go, but then the resolve not to to slip back into our obstructive patterns. This is an important thing. Someone by the name of Lichtenberg once said, to many people, virtue consists chiefly in repenting faults, not in avoiding them. There's a danger. This is a danger, especially for people who find it easy to apologize. Many people don't. But there are those who, I think the minority of people, can easily apologize. And I think what their vulnerability is thinking that, okay, I've done the work, now I can get back to, you know, hurting other people and myself. So there's this element of strength to upholding the precepts, strength, will, or the backside of will, which is won't. I won't keep doing this. I don't want to keep doing this, saying this. After the if we do the repentance portion of the ceremony, then we go into the first three of the 16 precepts. Those first three are the three refuges based on the three treasures. And I think most people of long practice would would agree that these are the three most important of the 16 precepts, because they're the base of it. The other 13 arise from this, or they encompass these first three treasures. They encompass the other 13, and this is how. When we're taking refuge in Buddha, remember the word Buddha means enlightenment, our enlightened nature. I think it's very hard for us as Westerners not to see this word Buddha as just this guy who lived in India a long time ago. And that then smacks of worship, which the Buddha, Shakyamuni, never wanted anyone to worship him. Buddha's not a god to us. So there's another big mistaken idea that people have who first come to practice. He's a tremendous model of wisdom and compassion and willpower. But a god, no, we don't traffic in gods in Zen or in Buddhism. We can certainly feel grateful and reverence for this human being who literally changed the course of history with his supreme perfect enlightenment. But really, when we're taking refuge in Buddha, we're taking refuge in our own Buddha nature, our own enlightened nature. To take refuge means to place our faith in, to put our to rely fully on. So I place my faith in my enlightened nature, this nature of completeness, of wholeness, this nothing lacking, nothing in excess nature that I was born with. This is crucially important in terms of the precepts, because it means that these precepts are not something that we just kind of hopelessly struggle to live up to. Yeah, they're hard enough for sure. And if you interpret the precepts very, very strictly, if you are very strict about interpreting the precepts, then we're all breaking these precepts every day in these small ways, less obvious ways. But in their fullest sense, these 16 precepts describe what the conduct would be of a supremely enlightened person. That is, someone who has realized her or his perfectly enlightened true nature. So the precepts then are not, they reflect this Buddha nature we're referring to when we say, I take refuge in Buddha. And resolve that with all beings, we can never separate ourselves from other beings. And resolve that with all beings, I will understand the great way whereby the Buddha seed may forever thrive. How do we water this Buddha seed? Well, you know how. Through practice, not just sitting, but practice in the broader sense, and through upholding the precepts. When we say, I take refuge in Dharma, we're saying, I place my faith in the truth, the law. Reality, not notions about reality, not ideas, not concepts, but things as they are. It's the Dharma. The Dharma is just a term that someone came up with many centuries ago to refer to things as they are. So when we take refuge in the Dharma, we're taking refuge in reality. Really, we are. Because there's nothing far-fetched about the Dharma. It's this. Not thoughts about those things. No, living in our thoughts is not the Dharma. It's the direct experience of it, of reality. In traditional terms, the Dharma, they say there are three characteristics of reality. And this is another point of Buddhist doctrine that is common to all the different schools, Zen and Tibetan and Buddhism and everything else. So let me repeat this, as I've said it many times in Taisho. But what are the three characteristics of reality? First is impermanence. Now, who is going to argue with that? Impermanence, flux, everything is changing all the time. Let's just trust that everyone can accept that. The second, life is, the second characteristic of reality is no self. Now, this is not so easy for many people to accept. But you know, you see, it's a natural. It follows from the first. If everything is in constant flux, then what kind of self, a fixed, permanent self, could we have? When we say self, we usually refer to this body-mind complex, this complex of our body, well, the skandhas, the five skandhas, our bodies, the body, our feelings, our thoughts, our consciousness, our choices. And then we usually just normally think of the self as also just the whole aggregate of all the decisions and stuff we've done in our lives. But awakening reveals that there is no fixed, permanent self, no enduring, unchanging anything. There is no entity that is unchanging. This is the hardest thing for us to accept, because our self concept has crystallized, has gotten so reinforced over the years in every kind of way by the language we use and all of the reactions every day of our whole lives. We form this sense of a self, and it's hard to accept that yes, whereas we do have there's a certain continuity to our character, to our personality, and you could call that a self, there is no roots. There is really no substance there. There's no substance to that we call the self. And then the third aspect, the third characteristic of reality, is that of dukkha, suffering, unsatisfactoriness. I won't go into this more because, anyone who doesn't see the many ways that they are dissatisfied or frustrated in their daily life or even suffering, worse yet, is just asleep. They're not noticing what's going on. And then the third of the three refuges, I take refuge in Sangha. It really means, strictly speaking, originally it meant to take refuge in the monastic order, but in our Western context, where there are virtually no monks in the traditional sense, celibate lifetime monks, It really means placing our faith in those who take the first two precepts, Buddha and Dharma. That is, who take those, take refuge in those two, our Buddha nature and the law of the universe, of change, no self-substance, and suffering. Taking the three refuges is equivalent to a kind of initiation into the Buddhist family. That is, the Sangha as those who accept the truth of Buddha nature and the Dharma. Technically, a Buddhist is one who takes the three refuges and who endeavors to uphold the five grave precepts. Those are the first five of the ten cardinal precepts. We'll get to those in a minute. Some Buddhist countries have the custom of doing this, taking the precepts on twice a month, on the first and the 15th days of the lunar month, so the full moon and the new moon, which really makes it a more or less formal and explicit recognition that failure to uphold the precepts is ceasing to be a Buddhist. That a fresh acceptance of the precepts and a renewed observance of them is required to restore our membership in the Buddhist family. And that's why people are encouraged to do Jukai, take the precepts over and over and over again. Each time, it's like renewing our commitment. It's considered the taking the precepts is considered the most important ceremony in the life of a lay person, which means all of us. The only ceremony considered more solemn and more important is monastic ordination. Yes, Tami Roshi said, taking the three refuges is the foundation and the whole of the Buddha way. The three resolutions and the ten cardinal precepts all other teachings and precepts flow from these three, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Another, to put it in the negative, you could put it this way: so long as we take refuge in the things of the world, we will be left wanting. Here's the contrast. So long as we rely on the things of the world, meaning money and success and appearance and all these other things, then we will be left wanting. It's not wrong. It's not bad. We can rely on our looks and our memory and our property and so forth, but it'll leave us wanting, leave us feeling dissatisfied. So taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha leads to the liberation from this state of dissatisfaction, the state of suffering, to the degree that we can live up to it. That's the hard part. The three resolutions, those are the next three of the 16 precepts, they sound very simple, almost kindergarten-like. I resolve to avoid evil, I resolve to do good, and I resolve to liberate all sentient beings. Or living beings, I guess we say now, for the three resolutions. I'm going to not dwell on these three because of the limitation of time this morning, and also because the next ten cardinal precepts articulate these three: avoiding evil, doing good, and liberating all living beings. Just to run through these, I won't dwell on any of these very long. Not to kill, but to cherish all life. Can be interpreted in so many ways. Yasutani Roshi said with regard to this that from the Mahayana Buddhist perspective, Zen is part of the Mahayana, to refrain, this really means to refrain from killing the mind of compassion and reverence. And then it's up to everyone to figure out what that means. For example, one way to interpret this first precept is to refrain from contributing to animal slaughter by eating meat. But this is not something imposed, certainly in Zen. Zen monasteries and temples and centers, almost without exception, don't serve meat for this reason. But it's something that each person has to sort out for himself or herself. I think just about equally important as in upholding this precept is the way in which we betray the mind of compassion and reverence by eating meat, not just because of the implications of the suffering of the animal, but because of the generation of greenhouse gases. This is something that I think is kind of the big white elephant that people in the environmental movement don't talk about much because they don't want to give up meat eating, but that according to very reliable sources, including the Union of Concerned Scientists, the amount of greenhouse gases generated through the livestock industry is more than all forms of transportation combined. So there are good reasons to give it up, but not to get crazy about it. It's I always say at workshops, you can come to awakening without giving up meat. And then there are these related things that you could spend two or three teishos talking about: war, abortion, suicide, euthanasia, accidentally killing, the death penalty, killing time as a form of killing. Gratuitously killing insects, animal experimentation. Second precept, not to take what is not given. Here, too, there are probably very few burglars in this room, or outright thieves, and what many people would think of as thieves. But there's so many ways of violating this precept of, see, we didn't say not to steal, because then a lot of people could just sort of check that off. Okay, I've never broken into a house and stolen things, but it's more this not taking what is not given, not swindling, not cheating, not taking advantage of others, not indulging in petty larceny against corporations, not being complicit in the misapportionment of world resources. Again, for each and every precept, there are different ways they can either interpret them strictly or not so strictly. I love what Dogen says on this precept. He says, each person naturally receives his allotted share in life. He need not think of it. He need not search for it. The allotted portion is there. I suppose most people would think this is just outrageous, ridiculous statement. But these are words from a profoundly enlightened person, and worth considering when we start to get anxious about whether we have enough or we will have enough when we're retired or whatever. Each person naturally receives his allotted share in life. This is one of the items of faith that underlies monastic ordination. You're just opening yourself to your karma, basically, is what it comes down to. This, of course, as just like the first one, this comes out of the violating this precept comes out of the fundamental delusion of self and other. 3, not to misuse sexuality, but to be caring and responsible. I devoted 3 teshos to this once, so we can't really get into it in any depth at all. In traditional terms, it meant adultery, not committing adultery. Means not having sex with someone who's underage or mentally disabled. But then you can go from there into date rape and much more subtle ways of manipulating people through sex. Sexual games, using one's attractiveness as in terms of power and conquest. Not using the promise of sex to entice someone to do something they don't want to do, or the threat of withholding sex. I like most of all, I like what Frank Pittman said here. He said, if you wonder whether certain behavior constitutes infidelity, I recommend that you ask your spouse. Not to lie, but to speak the truth. This is a huge one. Just to uphold this one scrupulously will change your life. I got into trouble once through lying, and it drove me into therapy, and it was a real revelation to understand what's behind lying. It's fear, of course. Fear of not getting something, fear of someone else's anger. Boy, it makes life so easy when you don't lie. And here, if you interpret it strictly, it also means all these kinds of, any kind of complicity in deception. No complicity with lies. No dissembling. No spinning things with clever use of words to commit a lie of omission. Many people tell themselves that if they're not outright lying, as we usually think of it, then they're okay. But then, you know, there are the lies of omission, leaving something out. This would be a violation of this precept. Deceit is harmful because it reduces one's being. We diminish ourselves every time we lie. Now, how can that be good for your practice, to diminish yourself like that in lying? It takes a toll. These things take a toll. We may try to tell ourselves that we can get away with these things, but just like little, what is that, death by a thousand cuts, paper cuts, it's just these little things add up. We're shaping with everything we say or don't say, do or don't do, hour by hour, minute by minute, we are shaping and reshaping our sense of who we are, which has such an effect on our ability to practice effectively. The most basic violation of this precept is self-deceit, rationalizations. And the antidote to self-deceit is zazen. Because when we're sitting, when we let that, all that structure of rationalizations and other thoughts, when we let that settle, then we see things, we see ourselves as we are, more or less. Here my favorite words are from some old guy. I got this from John Pauline. When he's working with him on some kind of job, who said, "I try never to lie because I like traveling light." Then the fifth, not to cause others to abuse alcohol or drugs, nor to do so myself, but to keep the mind clear. There's so many ways. I mean, this really covers all kinds of addictive behaviors, all kinds of substances, which may not be physical substances, that excite or dull the mind, that somehow put us into an altered state of consciousness. Besides alcohol and drugs, many, many other things. Think of all the kinds of addictions now they come up with. Overeating, addiction to pornography, addiction to shopping and to sex, and even over-the-counter painkillers and prescription drugs, and addiction to reading, addiction to fast driving. But in traditional terms, it's alcohol or drugs. I dug up something that the Buddha was instructing a young householder, and he gave the following admonition with regard to drinking and drugs. He said, "There are six dangers attached to addiction to strong drink and sloth-producing drugs. Here are the six." Tell me if you don't agree with the Buddha here. It's a present waste of money. It's number one. Increased quarreling. Two. Number three, liability to illness. Loss of good name. indecent exposure of one's person, and weakening of the intellect. Six and seven, I'll pair them together, so similar, not to speak of the faults of others, but to be understanding and sympathetic. And seven, not to praise oneself and disparage others, but to overcome my own shortcomings. There's a wonderful little kind of prose poem, a doggerel, really, that I'd like to read, because we can apply this to more than cookies. A woman was waiting, and I wish I knew who had written this. I would give the person credit, but I never learned. A woman was waiting at an airport one night with several long hours before her flight. She hunted for a book in the airport shops, bought a bag of cookies, and found a place to drop. She was engrossed in her book, but happened to see that the man sitting beside her, as bold as could be, grabbed a cookie or two from the bag in between, which she tried to ignore to avoid a scene. So she munched the cookies and watched the clock as the brazen cookie thief diminished her stock. She was getting more irritated as the minutes ticked by, thinking, if I wasn't so nice, I would blacken his eye. With each cookie she took, he took one too. When only one was left, she wondered what he'd do. With a smile on his face and a nervous laugh, he took the last cookie and broke it in half. He offered her half as he ate the other. She snatched it from him and thought, oh, brother, this guy has some nerve and he's also rude. Why, he didn't even show any gratitude. She had never known when she had seen Ben so galled, and sighed with relief when her flight was called. She gathered her belongings and headed to the gate, refusing to look back at the thieving ingrate. She boarded the plane and sank in her seat, then she sought her book, which was almost complete. As she reached in her baggage, she gasped with surprise. There was her bag of cookies in front of her eyes. If mine are here, she moaned in despair. The others were his, and he tried to share. Too late to apologize, she realized with grief that she was the rude one, the ingrate, the thief. Now, there is this phenomenon that I am convinced is at work when we are speaking of the faults of others, or praising ourselves and disparaging others, which is very often what we find fault with in others is what we will not face in ourselves. We somehow are in a state of denial about it. We are not conscious of this, in this case, this tendency to take what is not given. We don't want to see it. Doesn't fit with our precious notion about ourselves, but then we are left projecting it onto other people, and then it really bothers us. So what I have been doing for many, many years is when I see something in someone that annoys me, I notice it's getting under my skin consistently, this thing about this person, turn your mind around and look at yourself. How might I have that very same trait, and I just don't want to look at it? At the very least, just turning your attention around, taking it off the object of your criticism, is going to be a good thing. Even if you don't see it in yourself, just not picking at other people and judging other people, but looking, not, you know, we don't want to be judging ourselves either, but looking inquisitively at whether that same trait may be something we are harboring in ourselves without knowing. So that's 6 and 7. 8, not to withhold spiritual or material aid. Well, we can go back to Dogen's quote about each person having his allotted share in life. I'm just going to keep going. And 9 is not indulging in anger, but exercising, but resolve not to indulge in anger, but to exercise forbearance. This is another one I gave 2 or 3 consecutive teshos on once because it's such a source of problem to so many people. And it's especially problematic for people who think they have no problem with anger. And then the last one, number 10, is not to revile the three treasures. This one also kind of encompasses all the other 9. Not to really, any time we think of ourselves as just an ordinary, unenlightened person, strictly speaking, to think of ourselves as an unenlightened person is a violation of this precept. Now, a few more comments before we close. What's the big distinguishing feature of Great Jukai, which we have only every 3 years, is the six realms, the tunnel of showing the 6 realms of unenlightened existence. I gave my last Teisho a few weeks ago was dedicated to that topic, the 6 realms of unenlightened existence, and I want to encourage people to take their time and on your way out to the Buddha Hall at 5 o'clock to take your time going through this audio visual presentation of each of the 6 realms. We have a kind of a dilemma. Because in this weather, it's so nasty out and kind of raw and cold. It's not so easy to have a leisurely walk through the 6 realms. Kind of hellish, actually. Come to think of it. But what I thought, we'll get to this with the announcements in just a minute. But I just wanted to make the point that a lot of people have put a lot of work into this 6 realms tunnel, and it pains me to think of people just scooting through it without really taking it in. It's really can be quite moving. Some of these realms are really, I've almost been brought to tears with one of them once or twice. I don't remember which ones, but it's a great reminder of how vulnerable we are until full enlightenment. We can evolve but also devolve through these realms. So I hope that people will find a way to take your time and going through them somehow. What I'm hoping is that Before 5 o'clock, when most people are going over in their robes, but before then, people might bundle up and be able to take more time going through them. We'll get into this in the announcements. Lastly, want to say that sometimes I think every Jukai day, morning of Jukai, there are people who wonder whether they should do it. People who may think, I don't consider myself a Buddhist, or I don't know if I'm a Buddhist, or I don't know if I can live up to these precepts. In some Zen centers, there's much more, Jukai is something that requires much more of people who go to it. But here, I follow the custom of my teacher and his teachers, which is to invite anyone whether you consider yourself a Buddhist or not, to, if you're not sure, but to come, because, you know, look at these precepts. What is, they're human precepts. They're precepts that will help any human to the degree that you can take them seriously and really apply yourself to them. It'll help simplify anyone's life, taking these precepts. And you don't have to sign anything in order to take the precepts, either before or after. You don't have to sign anything. Just to receive them and go on your way. All right, we'll stop now and recite the four vows.